Senate Judiciary Committee, February 7th, 1973, room 20 at 4 p.m. We'll be hearing Article 5 today.
Put them down there.
Continue our consideration of Senate Bill 80 and specifically Section 5 of Senate Bill 80. Mr. Shirk.
Right here, Senator.
Yes, please.
Senator, I'm an ex-FBI agent, a retired FBI agent, having had 32 years of law enforcement experience.
Would you state your name, please?
My name is Ronald E. Shirk, S-H-E-R-K. I'm presently a practicing attorney in Oregon City, Oregon, and I represent an organization called Americans for Effective Law Enforcement. We've submitted a written brief, and I've also submitted a Newsweek article describing the functions of our organization. I represent the Oregon chapter of AELE, which is a nationwide group of concerned citizens seeking, among other things, rules of law that will make criminal trials a search for truth rather than a search for error. First I'd like to say that the commission did a monumental job of research and codifying of the law of search and seizure. It's expertly done, and I don't find any fault with the committee for the manner in which they've codified it. However, we would prefer that the substantive law of search and seizure, as opposed from the procedural law, how to obtain a search warrant, how to return it, when it's to be returned, and so forth, the substantive law of search and seizure not be locked into statute. The law of search and seizure as it presently exists in the federal system and in most states, I believe in all states, is a matter of law laid down by judicial decision, primarily decisions of the United States Supreme Court. And these are, since Mapp versus Ohio in 1961, these rules are binding upon all of the state and local courts as well as the federal courts. Should the present Supreme Court relax the rules on search and seizure, and we had all of the Warren Court rules locked into substantive statutes, we would be bound by the statutes. It's a fundamental rule of law that if the state statutes are stricter than the federal rules, then the state statutes govern. This would mean that unless the legislature reconsidered the matter and amended the law, that it would be the law on search and seizure as it affects the police would be stricter in Oregon than it would be in the rest of the country.
What do you mean by strict?
Well, let's suppose, for instance, Senator Burns, that we had had the substantive law of search and seizure locked in 1968 at the time that the stop and frisk case, Terry versus Ohio, came down. Now, prior to Terry versus Ohio, nearly everybody felt that in order to make a frisk, and it's a limited right, of course, but in order to make a frisk, you had to make an arrest first. The Terry case allows, in a limited, to a limited extent, police to frisk a person being interrogated for large, hard objects, which could be guns or knives or weapons. If we'd had the substantive law locked into statute, Oregon officers would not have had the benefit of that stop and frisk decision.
I just didn't know which way you were concerned, if we're going to be left with too strict a law or not strict enough.
We're concerned that if we think the law is too strict now, Senator Burns, and if the Warren Court does relax the rules a little bit, and I think there's good reason to think that they will in view of some of the dissenting opinions in Coolidge versus New Hampshire, we don't want the Oregon law enforcement officers to be at a disadvantage as compared with the federal officers and the officers in other states. Our second concern is that in some respects, Article 5 places more restrictions on law enforcement and prosecution than existing law and decision. For instance, it would shorten the normal period of service of search warrants from 10 days to 5. Now, this isn't a big thing, because most search warrants, I imagine 99% of them are served within 48 hours of the time of issuance. But it's just indicative of what the statute would do. Section 16 restricts searches incident to arrest for minor offenses. At present time, the federal law, which governs all the state courts, is that any time you make an in-custody arrest, you've got a right to make a thorough search of the individual. Of course, it doesn't apply to giving somebody a traffic ticket or something of that sort. And Section 28 partially destroys the open fields concept. The Fourth Amendment says persons, houses, papers, and effects, and the federal courts have consistently held that anything that isn't a house or a curtilage, it's woodlands or parks or anything of that sort, are not covered by the Fourth Amendment.
Mr. Shirk, are you referring to sections of the bill or the yellow book put out by the criminal court?
The yellow book.
Well, I said
section 28, but it's in that draft of the proposed legislation.
Oh, here.
Not that one, Senator. I haven't seen that one. That one.
Well, I thought you were on search and seizure.
Yeah, that's...
Search and seizure starts with section 131.
Well, I'm not going to go over all of the sections of the bill anyway. I just mentioned that as an illustration of the sort of thing that we object to.
All right, but you might tell us specifically what passed it is that you're objecting to.
Well, section 28 in the... Thank you.
Is it the scope of the search? 137?
I don't wish to burden you by taking up the time to look the thing up. Now, I'm sorry I wasn't better brief, but I just merely mentioned those as things, three examples of things where they are tightening up the law rather than leaving it as it presently is. My third point, and then I will cease, is that there's really no need for this legislation. There's a tremendous mass of United States Supreme Court decisions on the subject of search and seizure, largely because of the number of federal cases that involve search and seizure. Every federal narcotics case involves search and seizure. Every moonshine case involves a search and seizure. And nearly every bank robbery case involves a search. So there's a tremendous amount of case law on the subject. The law is well known. I've been teaching it for the last 10 years for the FBI to probably several thousand police courses. Congress has not found it necessary to codify the substantive law in the federal system, and as far as we can determine, no state has yet done so. I think it's being considered by other states than Oregon, but it has not been done. If Article 5 would set up a massive statutory law on the subject, which would have to be interpreted by the courts, and I feel that it would confuse rather than clarify the situation. I think any prosecuting attorney or defense attorney would tell you that the Oregon courts are already doing a good job of enforcing the state and federal right of citizens to be free of unreasonable searches and seizures. And with that, I'll thank you very much for listening to me and close.
I think there may be questions for you, Mr. Shirk.
Fine.
Are there questions? Senator Hoyt.
I'm not a lawyer, sir, and so I don't know how to ask this question intelligently, but apparently we'd like to copy the search and seizure. There's difference in much of the law. It's kind of sacrosanct, and you don't want to codify the thing because there's lots of case law in it. Now, I'm sure there are other phases of the law that have lots of case law that are codified. Am I mistaken or right?
I think you're correct, Senator. The problem is that search and seizure is a very controversial field, both from the standpoint of people who are concerned with citizens' rights and from the standpoint of the criminals, the accused rights, and also from the standpoint of the police. they have what's called the exclusionary rule, and if the search isn't just right, the evidence is excluded. If I came in here with a gun and shot one of the senators, and escaped, and were found out on the street and were searched, and the gun found and compared with ballistically with the bullet in the senator's brain, they couldn't use the gun if the search wasn't up to snuff, even though it would be very cogent proof that I was the murderer. And so anything that makes it tougher on the rules on search and seizure is going to mean that more and more defendants are going to escape punishment because the evidence is suppressed.
I think you touched on that point exactly. Wouldn't it be easier if you were trying to teach me to be a policeman? You're a teacher, and I want to be a cop. You're trying to teach me. Wouldn't it be easier if you had a list of things instead of having to try to teach me case law that you say, this is what you do, this is what you don't do?
Well, it's really not that tough. People have sought to make it tough, but my course that I give out at the Oregon Police Academy on search and seizure only runs four 50-minute sessions, and I cover the whole thing.
Well, you
see
your point,
don't you?
I see your point. It would be easier for you to give me a syllabus out of the statute instead of a study of the case law.
Well, that sort of makes sense, Senator, but the big problem is that the law of search and seizure is in a constant state of flux. It was during the war in years. The Terry case that gave officers the right to stop and frisk was a 7-2 decision by the full Warren Court. Surprised us to no end, but we got it. My organization filed an amicus curiae brief with the Supreme Court, and they quoted quite extensively from our brief in handing down Terry. Berger Court, on the other hand, gave us Coolidge versus New Hampshire, which really tightened it up as to searches of automobiles more than it had been before. So the thing's in a constant state of flux, and whatever the Supreme Court says is what we are governed by.
Now, back to my first question, Madam Chairman. Aren't there the other branches of law that have to do with criminal procedures, there are none of them that vary as much, that seesaw off and down, yo-yo, as much as search and seizure?
Well, I think probable cause for arrest is another field very similar.
Anyway, do you want to pull that out of here, too?
Well, probable cause for arrest isn't in the statute. The courts have to determine probable cause in each case individually, Senator.
And you put this in the same category?
I put this in the same category.
I think I understand. Thank you very much.
Further questions? Thank you, Mr. Scherr.
Thank you, Senator.
Good to see you, Laura.
Senator Keith Burns has had a bill drafted. Which would postpone the recording of the district court. The Supreme Court asked me to have this bill drafted, so is it all right with you if the committee puts it in? Now, we're going to have before us going into effect right away, postponing it, and repealing it. So we'll have everything in front of us.
This bill will get everything in front of us.
Yeah, right. Okay. Yeah, well, I understand. Mr. Snauffer.
Madam Chairman, my name is William Snauffer. I'm an assistant professor of law at Northwestern School of Law, Lewis and Clark College. Before that, 4 years in private practice. Involved in defense criminal case, and before that a couple of years as a deputy district attorney in Multnomah County. I'm here today speaking on behalf of the American Civil Liberties Union. I did prepare testimony to give Monday afternoon. I believe I circulated that to
folders, yeah,
to everybody. I do have some extra copies. If unfortunately, Madam Chairman, when I prepared this, I prepared it with reference to Senate Bill 80, but as I go through it, I will be prepared to call to your attention the section numbers in the yellow draft code. As a general rule, the ACLU believes that codification of court decisions and statutes controlling search and seizure has some merit because police officers, as was pointed out in the earlier testimony, and private citizens would, we believe, have a better means of keeping up with and knowing the law of search and seizure. I think the that private citizens and police officers alike, not to mention lawyers, have a difficult time keeping up with the continual stream of search and seizure decisions. We think that a code would lessen the burden to some degree. The ACLU, however, does not support codification of bad court decisions, nor do we support proposals which impinge upon the rights of privacy enjoyed by private citizens in our society. We would like to see legislation which substantially increases privacy rights and which insists upon the existence of a search warrant prior to a search for and seizure of evidence. In the balance of my statement, I would like to analyze specific sections of Article 5. However, we do take the position that unless this committee is willing to or inclined to alter a number of the sections in Article 5, we would like to see you pass only the sections dealing with the procedures for obtaining search warrants, for consent searches, for standing to file a motion to suppress, and for disposing of those things actually seized. Now, if I could call the committee's attention to sections 133 and 134, which set up the procedures for obtaining a warrant. We were, as Mr. Lucas informed the committee on Monday, I was instrumental in helping the Criminal Law Revision Commission obtain the California statute concerning telephone search and seizure. We introduced this because we believe it's consistent with our position that a search should always receive prior authorization of a judge, and that the having the telephone available to the officer would assist and facilitate this particular function.
Directing your attention back to 131, we've had considerable testimony that the definition of judge shouldn't include JP. What is your thinking on that?
Well, I appreciate the problems that were mentioned with respect to Eastern Oregon and judges not willing to come out of a trial to take a telephone call from a district attorney and so forth, but, and that a justice of the peace might help this process. The problem that concerns me, however, is that many of the JPs are not judges. We are dealing when an officer, a district attorney, applies for a search warrant, a very kind of elusive concept with respect to the probable cause to conduct the search, and we believe that a trained lawyer should make this decision. And this is why I think that during subcommittee meetings we went on record as supporting the definition of judge as proposed to you by the commission.
And what do you think about broadening police officer? Specifically, the suggestions have been made federal agents, DA investigators, and liquor inspectors.
Well, I think, Senator, we went on record during subcommittee meetings as supporting this particular restriction of the scope. At the time, I think the testimony in subcommittee hearings more or less dealt with the problem of old private police officers, railroad police officers who had a special commission from the governor and so forth. I'm worried about district attorney investigators. I know, for example, Multnomah County, virtually all of them, I think, are police officers and would qualify under this definition. I don't know or have any experience with respect to outlying counties as to the qualifications and training they insist upon for district attorney investigators.
Are they DAs or are they police investigators?
What?
Are they DAs, deputies, sheriff? On what basis are they police officers?
No, they're just investigators hired by, they're on the district attorney staff.
I thought he said that they were police officers.
In Multnomah County.
In Portland they are, but
just
they're not
Portland.
Necessarily everywhere.
Well, what authority are they, a police officer?
They are full-time police officers.
Oh, are you people for investigators?
Yes, and then the DA finds an officer that he likes and works with and selects him for special duty.
The Multnomah County Sheriff gives him a couple, and the city police gives him some.
I thought they really were DAs, in fact.
Senator Burton.
In this regard, you know, what concerns me a little bit about it, I'd like to have your reaction, is that you've got the district attorney who's preparing the affidavit in the first place, ordinarily, and then that's challenged in court. And if you allow an investigator in his department to do it, then he's in court really defending something that he did. And it's different than where you got a phrase old man to fill out the affidavit of that, opposed to a police officer.
This is true, and also an untrained person, that is a non-deputy district attorney drawing up the affidavit, is more likely to make mistakes in setting forth all of the sufficient factual basis that a judge has to take into consideration, and therefore on a motion to suppress at a later time, if the mistake does creep in, it might result in suppression of the evidence.
I think the other part of Senator Brown's question was about FBI agents suggesting that they be included in the definition of police officers.
Well, the thing that bothers me with that is it's a good idea, but the FBI agent, I think, should be working with the local law enforcement agency. They probably are. But I think that a local officer should be involved in the process, and the FBI agent certainly can furnish all of the information to a local police officer, and he can use that then and state that in his affidavit and go ahead and get his warrant. But to allow an FBI officer to go straight to a judge without any local law enforcement involvement would concern me.
Senator Burns.
The other thing is, in affidavits in federal courts, they use double hearsay, where here in the state courts, right, they have to not identify the informant, but to show that he's reliable by having experience from before. And a FBI agent goes to a justice piece who wouldn't know this and might give him a double hearsay affidavit without showing any reliability on the part of the informant.
On the telephone provisions in sections 133 and 134, in looking at this, since we suggested that these be made part of the codification, and thinking about it subsequently, we are a little concerned that perhaps the original intent of the subcommittee of the commission was not carried into the legislation, and we would like to urge upon this committee to insert some language in the sections 133 and 134 to indicate that the purpose of the telephone method of obtaining the warrant is to be the exception rather than the rule. The rule should be, in all instances where this is practicable, the officer should go to and appear before and testify in front of the magistrate. And then only where this is impracticable due to emergency situations, timing factors, it may be 4 a.m. or something of this sort, only in those circumstances then should the telephone method be relied upon, so that the officers are not, during normal business hours, say, using the telephone method and the subsequent paperwork and so forth that's involved, they should be going in to the magistrate. We would like to suggest that. Secondly, we would like to suggest that if the telephone procedure is used, after it is used, the officer then go in and still appear and sign an affidavit stating the facts in his own writing and giving a verified sworn statement that would coincide with the recorded transcript. And the only purpose here is to ensure that the officer is being completely truthful in the facts which he stated over the telephone and goes on record twice, so to speak, as to why it was necessary for him to use the telephone method and the facts upon which he was relying in that case.
Senator Burns.
Are you still talking about 133 or 133?
Well, I was going to move on.
Could I?
Certainly.
This could be a copy by prior to subsection 4, putting some kind of a preface in there, the availability of the judge or the inaccessibility of the officer to the court or something of that nature, is that right?
Yes, sir.
Now, over here on the, you're talking about a post-arrest affidavit, file that for not necessarily a post-arrest,
post-search.
This is attempted to be covered by having the judge who received
the present subsection.
Put down what the man told it.
Yes, the present subsection requires that a transcribed statement be made. That the statute leaves it open as to how the transcription would be made, and that it then only shall be considered to be an affidavit for purposes of the section. And of course, the officer theoretically is under oath over the telephone when he's talking to the judge. But we would like the double insurance that he actually appear before the judge reasonably soon after the telephonic conversation and personally verify this information and make an affidavit and file it in the court file.
Is that in lieu of that last sentence or in addition
to? In addition to. I appreciate it's open to the argument that this is just an exceptional amount of paperwork, but we do believe that under these circumstances there should be an affidavit personally signed by the police officer, just as he would have had to do given the appropriate circumstances where he would have had the time in the first place to come before the judge. He's got to make an affidavit under oath, and if there are any subsequent proceedings, civil or otherwise, that might result from the testimony given over the telephone, we believe that citizens' rights are protected more if the officer has, in fact, committed his signature to the paper under oath, rather than the procedure here merely states that it shall be considered to be an affidavit, and we're not certain that that is sufficient under the circumstances. If I may, then, I would move on to Section 136, which deals with execution of the search warrant. And we oppose the no-knock provision of this section, which would allow the entry into private premises without prior announcement by officers of their identity and purposes. We prefer that matters affecting the privacy rights of citizens should be passed upon by judges prior to this kind of activity, and we would prefer to see, it's mentioned in commentary to Section 136, the New York statute, which requires or authorizes the judge to make a prior determination whether or not to dispense with the no-knock provision. Since what we're dealing with in search warrant situations is the invasion of a private citizen's rights, the ACLU prefers that this invasion be authorized in advance by magistrates. We don't think that officers who are in the hot pursuit of evidence and about ready to exercise the authority in the warrant are really psychologically in a valid frame of mind to make an honest, informed, neutral, detached decision as to whether or not circumstances justify dispensing with the knock and announce requirements. We think the New York statute would be a better model for this committee to follow.
You had mentioned Section 135, and therefore we assume you oppose the suggested changes of first omitting the expiration date on the face of the warrant and deleting the time 7 a.m. to 10 p.m. during which the warrant should be served.
No, Senator, and I, in preparing my statement, I did not want to burden the committee with detailed analysis of every single section in here. I wanted to highlight those things to which we were most strongly opposed. I said at the beginning, if we would like to see authorization by the committee, or that is a recodification in modern language of the warrant search provisions, so that 135 we do support.
I see.
As that. Section 137 deals with the scope of the search warrant, stating in effect that the search shall not exceed the authorization of the warrant, but it then goes on to allow the officer to seize those things that are not described in the warrant. We do oppose that portion of Section 137. We think that the proper function of the warrant is to permit by judicial decision the invasion of privacy, and that invasion should be limited by the scope of the warrant. It should go no farther, and if officers actually obtain probable cause to justify further invasions of privacy beyond that authorized in the warrant, that he should then seek out again the permission of the magistrate before going further into the premises being searched. Section 139, use of force in executing the warrants. We agree generally with this, with the contents of Section 139, but we're not quite able to see what is actually intended by paragraph 2A, which states, in effect, if an officer reasonably believes substantial risk things to be seized will be used to cause death, etc., or if their seizure is delayed, and that the force creates no substantial risk of injury to other persons and so forth, he can use deadly physical force. We don't really see what that adds to what is provided by 2B, which says that deadly force can be used by the officer when deadly physical force is necessary to defend that officer or another person from the threatened use or imminent threatened use. In other words, we believe that 2B sufficiently covers all of the possible circumstances that an officer might face, and we're just a little concerned that 2A might add some confusion to the law that perhaps is not really necessary. Now, if I may then move on to searches and seizures incidental to an arrest, getting into the warrantless area. Section 143, paragraph 2 particularly, the vehicle inventory search, the ACLU opposes this. We have a very difficult time finding valid reasons why automobiles need to be taken into protective custody, so-called, by police officers. The device is used very frequently, however, and generally the automobiles are taken into custody and just, in effect, permit a fishing expedition through the automobile. We believe that if police departments, often the justification is a concern for civil liability if the car is left out unprotected and so forth, we think that appropriate legislation could be perhaps added to the Tort Claims Act, which would set up some kind of an immunity there, but we do believe that very rarely is any requirement that an automobile be taken into custody. There's no particular reason why it can't be locked up and left alongside the street, or that the person who's being arrested at the time be allowed to make a choice, whether he wants to call his wife, have his wife come down, pick up the car, take it home, and so forth. But we feel that far too often the vehicle inventory search is merely used as a pretext for searching the car. The decision to take the car into custody, tow it down, and search it at leisure is not justified. Moving on then to Section 145, again, search of a vehicle incident to an arrest. We are opposed to that part of the Section 145 that allows the officer, I may be getting ahead of myself, what we're concerned with in Section 145 is that if a person is arrested in the car, this then allows a complete search of the car. We don't believe this is necessary. Again, it falls back onto the prior section I was talking about, pretext for searching the automobile. There's no reason why the individual can't be taken out of the car and searched outside of the car and then taken on down to the police station, the car locked up and left where it is. We think that Section 145 is based partly on Chambers versus Maroney, which U.S. Supreme Court more or less said, yes, you can search vehicles incident to an arrest. The problem is that Chambers versus Maroney had a bunch of facts, which I'm not prepared to recite at this time, which we think limits that case somewhat to the particular facts involved in that case, whereas this statute would now allow any time somebody's arrested in a vehicle to search the car, and we object to that.
Don, I'm right, you can't arrest for a violation. There's no arrest for a violation. You can arrest for a violation.
search and seizure by consent, which is covered in sections 147 through 150, we support this because we believe it reasonably protects persons from unknowingly waiving their rights. There's a good policy matter contained in these statutes which limits the scope of the search pursuant to consent to the extent of the consent given, and requires that the person know what he is consenting to under all circumstances. We do or would like to see, however, suggest to the committee that a practice which is customarily used by many police departments be inserted in these statutes, and that would be to require the consent to be in writing. Most police departments will have a little 3x5 or 5x7 card in which the person consenting to the search will sign it. We would like to see this specifically required in the statutes because this would do a lot to avoid subsequent litigation over whether or not consent was really ever given in the first place. Section 152, the vehicular searches, we oppose this, the part of Section 152 which would allow the search to go on to all occupants of the vehicle. Mr. Lucas pointed out to the committee, and it's also indicated in the notes to the commentary here, that there are some constitutional difficulties with that. We do not believe that mere stopping of an automobile justifies or gives any probable cause to go on and search all of the occupants in that vehicle. And I think the quotation in the commentary to United States versus DeRee pretty well takes care of the constitutional aspects of that provision. Sections 155 through 158 establish the so-called inspectorial searches of non-licensed premises. ACLU strongly opposes these provisions. We see no compelling need for the elaborate or cumbersome machinery. We see in it a danger that it will be used more or less as a pretext situation by various law enforcement agencies to get around some of the strict requirements of a search warrant. We also specifically object to the section which states that deadly physical force can be used in the emergency inspectorial search. I believe that's in section 158, subsection 4. We see no reason at all to permit the use of deadly physical force in this particular section. We do believe that if there is sufficient indication to the inspection officers that indicates that deadly force might be required, that in all probability, it's very difficult to conceive of other fact situations, there's going to be some evidence that a crime is being committed and the officer, a legitimate police officer, might well have probable cause to get a search warrant in the first place, in which case then the deadly force requirement would be permissible. Sections 159 through 163 establish machinery for disposing of things seized during the course of a search. We do support enactment of those provisions because we believe that it would be a desirable thing to have an orderly sort of mechanism statewide for handling property that comes into the possession of police officers, police departments, and that the court sets up machinery for hearings, and we believe that this is a desirable thing to have as well. Section 164 establishes the right, which already exists, of course, to have file a motion to suppress. We support that. We believe it gives more orderly, more order to the motion to suppress procedure. We specifically support the provision in subsection 2 that the prosecution gives written notice to the defendant. I think there were some objections by prosecution on Monday to this, saying, well, this is just so much more paperwork and we're already overburdened with it. But at least what it does is advise the defendant, yes, we've got the evidence, we're going to use it against you at trial, and so get busy and file your motion to suppress and let's dispose of that issue before trial. So we think that's a good idea to have that in there. Section 165 has to do with standing. We very strongly support this. A motion to suppress may be made by any defendant against whom things seized are to be offered in evidence at a criminal trial, no matter from where or from whom seized. Mr. Lucas advised you that the District Attorney's Association is very strongly opposed to this. But the problem is really that Oregon is not, to my knowledge, taken a firm stand on this. At least the courts have not, and we believe it's a good policy matter that the legislature ought to step in and take a hand with, because what we're talking about in the exclusionary rule is improper police conduct. If the improper conduct is directed at somebody other than the defendant who actually winds up on trial, it's still improper police conduct and should be subject to some challenge. There is, in my judgment at any rate, based on some research that I've done in connection with some cases, very strong policy in the federal courts to liberalize standing, even though the federal rules of criminal procedure have a kind of a narrow interpretation of what standing is. But there are some cases in the Ninth Circuit which give people who have very, very nominal association with the premises search the right to raise the issue of trial. So we're strongly in favor of Section 165. 166 we're strongly opposed to. We don't believe that the exclusionary rule should be abandoned. We are concerned here that, as the commentary states, the draft is novel. It's based upon the Model Code of Pre-Arraignment Procedure, which the American Law Institute has drafted. It has not been enacted anywhere. We don't have any experience with it. This is, in effect, a very kind of a negative way of looking at it by saying, well, because it's new and we don't know how it'll work, it's a bad thing. But the problem here is, how do you determine what is a substantial violation? There are some suggestions in the commentary. I suggest that those standards, criteria, whatever they might be called, are extremely vague and very, very difficult to define. And some of them even beg the question. For example, if a search is a substantial violation, then isn't that the same question as the extent of deviation from lawful conduct? Aren't we, in effect, asking the same kind of question? A lot of the proponents now of doing away with the exclusionary rule, it's become kind of a fashionable thing to criticize it because people say, well, it doesn't work very well. And there is tending to be a lot of literature and legal periodicals to the effect it should be done away with. Everybody is fond of quoting Justice Berger's opinion or dissent in the Bivens case, but I would remind those that Justice Berger said, I would hesitate to abandon yet the exclusionary rule until some meaningful substitute is developed. Even Justice Berger is unwilling to abandon the exclusionary rule at this particular point in time. The subcommittee, when it started out, the consideration of search and seizure said, well, if we do away with the exclusionary rule, what do we do in its place? However, there was never any consideration given to develop an alternative. None ever was. And I think that this is an extraordinarily complex matter in and of itself that probably ought to be deferred to a later time. If we're going to do away with it, let's have a thorough study of just that and see if we can come up with something that does accomplish the purpose of the exclusionary rule.
Senator Hoyt.
As a matter of fact, it wouldn't be quite possible that this, as written here in the proposed draft, could very well, assuming it's your defendant, well, this will be to your advantage as well as to your disadvantage. If the judge had discretionary power as to what should be included in 68, could it be excluded? Unless you want to throw out all evidence, but you might say, well, you got a point there on this.
Well, the problem, though, as I see it, is we don't know what is meant by a substantial violation of search and seizure law. And the draft is very pro-police, you might say, in that sense, that the officer, in effect, has to just willfully violate the defendant's right, break down his house, break into his house without any justification. justification whatsoever before the evidence will be suppressed as kind of a punishment to that particular officer. It may mean just that, and that only, you know, some judges might then take the position, well, that's the only kind of violation that would justify suppressing the evidence. But what happens if an officer lies, for example, in obtaining an affidavit for a search warrant? I think that in that instance, as well, the evidence should be suppressed. But we're setting up here a very kind of, Mr. Lucas used the word quicksand. I agree with him. We don't know what we're talking about. And at least under the present system, we can look at the case law and try and determine whether or not the particular facts of the case at trial match up with another case and decide whether the motion should be, whether the evidence should be suppressed. Very briefly, Section 168, I would like to call to the committee's attention. ACLU opposes Section 168, and we would specifically point to the fact that we disagree with the commentary here, which says that 168, in effect, would follow or closely reflects present Oregon law and practice. We disagree completely. Under present practice, we have what is called a motion to controvert. And ORS 141.150 specifically says that if you have some basis for challenging the facts in the affidavit which underlay the search warrant, that you can go to the magistrate who issued it and controvert those facts. So there would be a substantial change in this procedure, and in effect, I think would do away with it. Here, the only thing that can be challenged is, as I understand it, the good faith of the person making the affidavit, and you can't go any farther. Well, that's fine, and the police officer generally does act in good faith, but what if his informant is acting in bad faith and is purposely setting up a defendant and purposely setting up a bunch of lies in order to get into a particular person's house where, fortuitously, once they're in there, they find some other evidence. So we're concerned that Section 168 actually deprives Oregon citizens of some very substantial rights that they now have. Section 169, we oppose. The general idea here that in all cases, apparently, or virtually all cases, the informant, his identity will be kept secret. We're particularly concerned about subsection 1B, which says that, in effect, that the informant's identity will be kept secret if the judge, alone and in camera, determines from the affiant by a preponderance of the evidence that the confidential informant exists and is reliable. The model code on which this is based says, as I recall it, that there has to be convincing and independent corroboration of the informant's existence and of his reliability before the identity remains a secret. In other words, the model code provides substantially more protection than is contained in this.
Yes, Senator Burns.
The model code is fairly close to present Oregon law, isn't it?
Well, to be honest, Senator, I've never really had a problem where I've really had to get into it in any depth.
Oregon law, is this on the affidavit?
Yeah.
On the affidavit, why they have to state that they know the person, have confidence in him, and then have to give history to supply. And
to show his reliability, yes.
Yeah, they used it before. So do you think the language of the model code states the same thing essentially?
I'm not certain, at least this particular section, whether that's always the situation. At least under the case law, you have to have, the affidavit has to show that the informant is reliable. This has to be established. I think, though, Senator, there are a couple of Oregon Court of Appeals cases which say that this has to be by clear and convincing evidence rather than just a preponderance. I don't have I think one of the cases is State versus Douglas, but I don't have those citations.
Could you send that to us, please?
Yes, certainly. I'd be happy
to. Mr. Henning might have that.
I believe that concludes my remarks.
Questions of now. Senator White?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If you have testimony which duplicates the foregoing testimony, we would appreciate your just noting your position to be in accord with the foregoing witnesses. Mr. Henning?
Madam Chairman. My name is Jim Henning. I'm the director of the Metropolitan Public Defender's Office in Portland, Oregon. By way of introduction, I might note that our office of 12 attorneys handles approximately 20% of the defendants who are accused of crime within the state of Oregon, approximately 40% of those accused of crime in Multnomah County. Prior to accepting that job, I was a deputy district attorney in Multnomah County, and prior to that time, with the Public Defender's Office in Chicago. Much of what Bill Snoffer said, I go along with, and in line with your request. I will just point out where I differ. If I don't mention a section, our office has no objection to it. There's several that we strongly favor. One area that we strongly like is the idea of the telephone affidavit, and we would like to see this strengthened even more. Unlike Mr. Snoffer.
Well, there might be an initial question we would have to you is, what is your position toward codifying the law of search and seizure?
I oppose the codification, and I oppose the entire area, unlike Mr. Snoffer. I believe, first, that what this will do is establish a double burden on the courts. Not only will the courts have to determine whether or not the search or the seizure was reasonable under the Constitution, but also whether it was reasonable underneath the particular statute. So they're really going to be making two decisions. And I think that this would be very unfortunate. All that we're going to do is produce a second series of case law, statutory as opposed to the constitutional law. And I don't think that we need this. In the commission hearings, there was a great deal of statement that we needed these rules in order to educate the police officers. The only way that the police officers will know what the particular law is. I think there's an easier, faster, safer way of doing this, and this would be through the Bureau of Police Standards. I know that there are many courses given to police officers. We heard about some earlier. I've taught some myself. I know the state police teach others. And I would prefer to see search and seizure taught by the Bureau of Police Standards, by the state police, by the district attorney's office. I think if there are changes in the law, and there are major changes, and every so often a major change does occur, it can be handled quicker and more safe by that education method. The individual cases, though, basically come down to a fact situation. And I think one of the problems is that in codifying search and seizure law, we're trying to foresee every single fact situation. And I just don't think that that can be done. You have to develop it on a case-by-case basis. Most of the education that I see given to police officers is very simple. They say, this is what the rule is, this is what you can, this is what you can't do, and then they refer to the cases and they say, these are examples of what we mean, and this is all that is necessary, I believe. That's my basic position on the codification of the search and seizure law as far as the substance is concerned. As far as the procedure, I believe that has to be very closely defined because this is what we work with day in and day out, and it's too important to let slide. Any questions? Okay. As far as the telephone affidavit, I would like to see this strengthened. I personally feel that the police officer should be able to get a warrant simply by picking up a telephone or calling in from a squad car. I think this is necessary because I like the idea of the magistrate, the detached, neutral observer, interposing himself between the police officer who's in the field in the heat of battle and the rights of the individual citizen. But I think this can be handled by a telephone system. What I would like to see in order to strengthen this is a section in either 133 or 134 which would require that a warrant always be obtained, simply because of the ease with which a telephone warrant can be obtained, that a warrant always be obtained unless there are emergency circumstances, and if a warrant is not obtained for a search, that the state would have a heavy burden of showing that that particular emergency existed. In other words, that there was good cause for the police officer not to use that neutral, detached magistrate. And again, in section 136, subsection 3, we are opposed to letting the police officer decide on the scene whether or not to do away with knock and announce prior to entry of a premises. It is too important a decision. Too many human lives are at stake. Too many important rights are at stake to do away with that knock and announce. There are many cases when I agree the police officer should not knock and announce who they are first before going in. However, they usually know this information when they call the magistrate. And because of the telephone communication, they're likely to be calling the magistrate while they're sitting outside the house just before they go in. It would seem to me that it would be very simple for the magistrate to again exercise his independent function and decide whether or not knock and announce should be done away with in this particular case. Again, I would be willing to see an exception to that, such that if the police officer had started to perform a search under a warrant or even without a warrant under those remarkable circumstances, and the situation changed, he was unable to get back to the magistrate for the authorization, that this would not necessarily do away with the results of the search. But again, I would stress the fact that the magistrate should be making that independent decision. As far as the return of the property sections, that's section 159 through 163, we strongly support these sections. In Multnomah County, all too often, a defendant, sometimes who is acquitted, sometimes who is not, goes through a long, complicated procedure in order to retain or get back any of the property that was seized from him. And this establishes a set procedure by which that property may be returned. And I think safeguards the rights, not only of the individual who had property seized, but also the victim of a crime, because it gives him an opportunity, independent, I believe, of the criminal action, to come in and contest whether or not that is really his property. Section 166, we strongly oppose. Again, it does away with the exclusionary rule. And I would repeat Mr. Snoffer's feeling that it would require, my estimate is 2 years of full committee hearings just on an alternative solution. And you would have to look very closely at who would be responsible. In other words, are we going to put the responsibility on the state, on the individual police officer, police departments? How are we going to come up with an alternative solution? I don't believe that we have one now. I think if I saw one that was viable and had been addressed by all of the interested parties, then I would agree with doing away with the exclusionary rule. However, I don't see that alternative at this time. We know that there is bad police work. We know that, unfortunately, some police officers do not always tell the truth. All that we have at this point is the exclusionary rule. I would like to see an alternative to that, but that just doesn't exist at this time. Also, on section 168, we oppose that particular codification because it allows the state to rely only on good faith of the officer. Now, this is fine, and it's a good protection in a civil action against the officer. However, also it allows the state to rely upon false evidence, and we oppose the state at any level relying on false evidence in order to obtain an affidavit or maintain a criminal action. As far as section 169, this is the identification of the informant. That particular section I'm aware of because I had a similar motion before Judge Crookham, and I believe that this particular section is patterned after that particular motion. Basically, what it is asking is that there be an independent method by which the state and the defendant can be satisfied that an informant really exists and that he is reliable before we rely on his information in the particular affidavit supporting the search warrant. As I understand the law at this time, the identity of the informant is not going to be revealed, and I don't believe the law is going to get any less strict than that. Unless the informant was actually involved in the criminal incident, the state does not have to reveal him. They have a strong right to protect the individual informant so that the information coming from informants may be used by the police department. I'll agree with that. However, I think there should be a check other than the police officer himself on whether that informant really exists and whether he is reliable. Our office, simply because of size, is collecting a large enough number of cases to cause us to have some doubts whether or not all of these informants really are reliable, or whether, in some cases, whether they actually exist. I am willing to allow a judge who is experienced question an individual police officer in chambers in order to determine whether or not that informant exists. This allows the judge to ask specifically, who is the informant? What other cases did he make? Where are your police reports on those particular cases? Exactly what information did he give you? These are all questions which we are not allowed to approach in open court because they might tend to reveal the identity of the informant, and the state exercises their privilege and keeps it out.
Senator Burns.
Yes.
How about having them produce the informant in camera?
That was what I requested originally, and at the subcommittee hearing, they said less than that. I would like to see the informant produced if the judge is not satisfied at the end of that particular hearing with the police officer.
Wouldn't he have the authority to request that?
I don't believe so now. In a recent case out of the Court of Appeals, State of Oregon versus Renea Wright, the Court of Appeals, at least in dicta, indicated that the judge probably doesn't have that right, although they ruled on that case on another matter. I'm not sure that without a statute they would have that particular right. As far as the wiretap sections, I don't know enough about those particular areas. As I understand, it's merely a codification of the present Oregon law.
Questions of Mr. Henning? Thank you, Mr. Henning.
I wonder, Madam Chairman, if, since apparently you and Johnson Wilson Clark agree on a lot of things, if it's possible, you didn't give us any notes, but maybe you could give us a kind of combined, consolidated statement.
I will send some notes down. I apologize.
I was thinking about getting them all together because you're both pointing to the same point of view, and if these were all organized together, it would be very helpful to me.
I have copies of his notes, and I will make comment reference to those when I send the notes down. Thank you.
Larry Dare.
My name is Larry Dare. I'm presently chairman of the Oregon State Bar Committee on Criminal Law and Procedure. During the drafting of the procedure code, I was secretary of that committee. I would like to mention preliminarily, since the subject has come up during prior testimony, what the status of my testimony and any other person who appears before you in the future representing the committee actually is with respect to the Bar Association. The proposed procedure code was not before the membership of the Oregon State Bar at its last annual meeting simply because it was not prepared at that time. The Oregon State Bar takes the position that it will only speak as an association on matters that have come before its entire membership. Consequently, nothing that is said by myself or any other member of the committee is a statement that can be taken as representation of the entire membership of the bar. However, we are the committee that has been delegated the authority by the bar to review this subject matter, and my comments do represent the consensus of that committee. Ordinarily, I would not think that it was appropriate to attempt to rehabilitate the efficacy of the investigations of our particular committee. However, in light of Mr. Platt's comments on Monday, I feel that a few statements in defense of our examination into this code are warranted, and I'll try and be brief with those. Mr. Platt indicated, as you'll remember, that our committee met in June of 1972 and spent only 3 hours of deliberation on Article 5 search and seizure, and implied that the DAs controlled that meeting. I'd like to point out that through the entire drafting process of this code, each individual member of the committee received copies of the preliminary drafts at each stage and copies of the subcommittee and committee minutes. That at the initial revision commission subcommittee meeting on search and seizure, 6 members of our 12-member committee were present, in addition to Don Paulette, who of course has been the project director and also a member of our committee, and I would submit probably the best source of information about what was happening with the proposed code. There were 2 district attorneys and 3 defense attorneys present at that subcommission meeting. Thereafter, there were about 5 other subcommission meetings, and our committee was represented by 1 or 2 members at each of those meetings. So that by the time that we met in June, each member of the committee had had an opportunity to review these matters and had participated in some of the earlier decision making. At that meeting, the committee made approximately 20 specific proposals with respect to Article 5. Of those, approximately 13 are presently incorporated in the draft. One of those was a significant one, of course, which recommended that warrantless search procedures not be codified. That was not included in the draft.
Could you tell us briefly what your position is on codification of search and seizure?
Speaking for the committee, the consensus, well, in fact, the unanimous decision of the committee, with Don Paulette abstaining at the June 72 meeting, was to oppose codification of warrantless search and seizure. Our committee met again last Saturday with a somewhat modified membership and adopted the same position. I'd like to point out that at that meeting there were 6 defense attorneys and 4 district attorneys present, yet the decision was the same.
How many were present previously?
There were 9 members present. Don Paulette abstained. 5 were district attorneys. 3 were defense attorneys. All were in favor. I make no stand that I am personally an expert in this field, but I would point out that Chap Milbank and Tom Kerrigan were the other 2 defense attorneys, and I think they are, and they opposed codification. So the committee has, since last summer, continuously opposed it. We have appeared before the subcommittee and the full commission to present that.
You only opposed warrantless search and seizure. The other parts of the section, you approve codification. I'm not specific section.
We have specific comments, but generally speaking,
yes.
Yes. And I think that you'll find during the course of this testimony that with one exception that I've heard so far, that being Professor Platt, everybody agrees that the warrantless search is the area which should not be codified. The reasons will vary, but the consensus is clear. As a result of our meeting of last Saturday, a number of additional proposals did come out of the Criminal Law Committee, and I will very briefly run through those, and I will submit to the committee those matters in the next day or two. A couple of these are, you will note, repeats of the things which Mr. Lucas testified to, and I won't spend any time on them. It's not hard to understand why they came up, because Mr. Lucas is a member of the committee. He raised them, we considered them, some we agreed with, some we didn't. In section 133, we recommend that the language in subsection 3, as far as possible in the last sentence, be omitted, and the reasoning on that has already been brought before your committee.
That was because it was redundant?
Yeah, we feel that in any sort of a codification, this is just a general rule that less language is better than more unless it has a particular purpose and meaning, and we feel that as far as possible it doesn't have that particular purpose or meaning.
Point of view, have it tainted the DA's on it too? Or has,
Well, I've attempted by my earlier comments to rehabilitate our committee and show you that it is not DA-oriented. However, since you mentioned that, Senator Hoyt, I'd also like to mention a thought which has occurred to me, and that is it would be possible to assume that if the district attorneys oppose something in this code, then it must be granting more individual rights and being less strict for policemen. I would submit that this is the farthest from the truth. It's an unfair statement to make with regard to the district attorneys. And I think that if we didn't feel that the district attorneys were attempting to guard our rights, that we would have to make some very far-reaching changes in our criminal procedure beyond what is proposed by this code, or we'd all be in trouble.
I had a question.
Senator Burns.
Are you a district attorney?
No, I'm not. At the time that the drafting was taking place, I was a private practitioner and defense attorney. At the present time, I am a county counsel and on occasion prosecute dog cases against people in our county. But I don't think that my views have changed. With regard to Section 137, scope of search, we recommend deletion of the last sentence, which would not allow an officer to take into custody items which he did not reasonably expect to find at the time that he acquired the warrant. The problem there is that there may be a situation where there's a vast number of items which could be named in the warrant. If you've been tracking a person for quite some time and he has been a very prolific burglar, you wouldn't name them all. If you found some, you could have to stop at the first one. That's another area that has been discussed. I won't go into it beyond that. Section 140 with regard to return of the warrant. We agree with previous testimony that subsection 1 is an extra step not in the present law and one which would serve no purpose. That's with regard to returning an unexecuted warrant. Sections 141 through 154 are those areas that speak to the warrantless search. We recommend deletion of all of those sections. I don't know that I can improve too much upon the testimony that has gone before me here today as to the reasons for that, although I think Mr. Hennings hit upon a point that's been in my mind since the beginning of this, and that is that if we're worried about a proliferation of court cases, the court cases are there to interpret the Constitution. If we add statutes, we're simply going to have more court cases interpreting the statutes. The existence of a statute cannot preclude the cases unless the statute is broad enough to speak to every individual fact situation, and of course that's impossible. Move on to section 158. This is the last section of the inspectorial searches. The committee reviewed the entire inspectorial searches and felt that there was a real need for such a search as it was provided with the procedural safeguards that are in the draft. However, we did feel for a number of reasons that Section 158, allowing emergency searches, was repugnant to individual rights and was not absolutely necessary. This is the section which includes, amongst other things, the ability to use deadly physical force. We simply feel that in an inspectorial search situation, there always would be an opportunity to obtain an order from a judge if it was necessary.
What about the liquor people?
Well, of course, that would go back to the definition of, are you speaking of those people who would be considered inspectors?
I guess really, but it's really better than the same.
Inspectorial searches would include a broader class of people than police officers, but with more limited powers. Section 159 single out a just one word in subsection 4 of that. We're in agreement with the series of sections dealing with return of seized property. We suggest in subsection 4 that it might be difficult for a police officer to determine what is a rightful claim, and suggest that that word be substituted for the one undisputed. If there is a dispute, then that should be a matter to be determined by a judge. But if there's not, there's no reason why the police officer on the spot cannot return the property. Section 164, relating to motions to suppress evidence. The committee felt that requiring prior notice of a prosecutor of the things which he would introduce in evidence which were seized to start the suppression procedure is unnecessary in light of the discovery provisions which are covered later in the code. We caution, though, that in our suggestion that prior notice be eliminated, that it only be so eliminated if discovery procedures at least as broad as those suggested in the code are in fact adopted. It would be a duplication in our estimation. Sections 165 to 169 relate to procedures under motions to suppress, and some very substantive things included amongst those procedures. Previous testimony has spoken to individual sections amongst those, primarily against them, with a few exceptions. Our committee felt that sections 165 through 169 should simply be deleted from the code, and basically for the same arguments that brought to bear on the warrantless search area. This is an area that is presently taken care of in the case law, and that would simply add confusion rather than detract from it to codify it. Are there any questions?
Any questions of Mr. Dare? Thank you, Mr. Dare. In view of the lateness of the hour, we would certainly appreciate brevity and just stating your position if you're in accord with a previous witness. Mr. Keith Kinsman, since you come from a distance, will you?
Thank you, Senator. I will be brief. I'll tell you first that I have prepared copies of my comments today, of my comments before you before, and of on the things that I didn't get an opportunity to comment on. I have copies of those that I'll submit to you.
Thank you.
I'd briefly tell you that as to Article 5, Mr. Roger Rook, our district attorney in Clackamas County, and let me state that my name is Keith Kinson. I'm a deputy district attorney in Clackamas County. Mr. Rook has asked me to tell you that we oppose Article 5, that we urge you not to recommend its adoption. Those portions that have been talked to before, because they are a codification of constitutional rules, and the other areas that have been spoken to because of the many errors, the many inconsistencies, the confusion that it causes, the omissions that have been left, and we think it's a poor job of drafting, and we think that it would take substantial revision on your part to be able to recommend their passage, and we urge you not to recommend them.
Thank you, sir. Any questions? Jack Frost.
Senator, likewise, I've had an opportunity
would
by
you
now.
State your name,
yes,
for the record.
My name is Jack Frost. I'm the district attorney for Linn County. I only mean by way of brevity to say that I've likewise prepared my remarks in writing. Fortunately, since I didn't have the opportunity Monday to get before the committee, I've had time in the meantime, rather hurriedly, to put my remarks together. I think first of all, it's only fair to say that not only am I the district attorney for Linn County, I have the anomalous position of being the secretary of the District Attorneys Association, also the secretary of the Bar Committee we're speaking of currently. I think what's more important to you is that I did attend all but maybe two or three of the subcommittee meetings as this was being reviewed, and I've attended the bar committee meeting, the district attorney meeting, the whole business. I think in order to try to make my point, I will quote to you some of the remarks I have to say. I'm reminded of a story told me by a sergeant when I was in service. He told me of a story. He told me that on one occasion he was ordered to give a briefing to a group of officers. And when he walked in the room, lo and behold, not only were they officers and he was a sergeant, but they were all at least one-star general. And he began his remarks by stating, and I say to you, that there are many people who are more familiar with the subject than I am, but after looking over the room, the sergeant said, unfortunately, I don't see any of them before me here today. I do not presume to be so bold as the sergeant. Practicing district attorneys and practicing criminal defense attorneys work with this subject daily. With rare exception, I find that they disagree with the codification of the warrant of search area. I have, from the very first meeting I attended, taken the same position, and I hold to that position.
You're objecting to all of Article 5 or only the
I
warrant?
I am objecting, Senator, if I recall the numbers correctly, sections 141 through sections 154, and then those sections which, again, have been called substantive, which amount to sections, well, at least I can remember 167, 168, the standing, that sort of thing. I'm sorry if I could refer, maybe I could find it, but I'm trying to say that I think I agree with the consensus that Mr. Durr speaks of, and that most accurately reflects what I have to say.
Thank you very much. A question? Thank you, Mr. Frost. Holly Holcomb? I'm sorry to have kept you so long, but these people come from long distances.
Madam Chairman,
members, I'm Holly Holcomb, Superintendent of State Police, and I'm going to be very brief. I've been around long enough to know when the committee looks tired. The only thing I wanted to bring out was we're opposed to Section 131 in regards to leaving the justice of peace out of the definition of a judge for practical reasons that have already been stated to you many times over, for instance, the problems in Eastern Oregon and so forth. We think the definition of a police officer as written here is okay as far as we're concerned. We think there's enough police officers around to serve warrants when it's necessary.
Pardon me, the matter that you mentioned about other inspectoral functions, you're not worried about that.
I think you can find almost 4,000 police officers now available to serve this type of a warrant. I think they can be found. In other words, I don't think you should have any more people involved.
Does that have any relationship to your budget?
Could be, man. It might come as a shock, especially to some of the district attorneys and so forth, but looking at Article 5 through the eyes of a police officer and on behalf of the state police, we find very little to complain about. In fact, we feel that codifying case law on search and seizure will be beneficial to police officers by giving them some guidelines.
Including warrantless search?
Even warrantless search, yes. As it is now, of course, the Supreme Court likely to change these things as they go along, but presently, being in the state police organization, having to operate in each county, we have a problem presently trying to get the district attorneys to agree on any one of these things. This really is one of our problems. So this would be of help to us if... I'm sure that there's things in here that if I was a lawyer, I could find fault with it. But basically and generally, we think it's a good idea.
Sorry to interrupt you. Holly, I don't want to start dogfighting, but it sounded to me like the gentleman that was an FBI master in the city.
He had to leave.
Was teaching your fellows down at the police academy.
No, he doesn't teach us.
He doesn't teach your fellows.
I think he's talking about teaching at the Board of Police Standards and Training, which
not
is not our academy.
Oh, I see. You have a separate
I'm sure he's an excellent teacher. I know him very well. I've known him for many years.
And
but I don't think it's that easy to teach this subject.
Oh. opportunity. I just thought there was a dichotomy there, but there's not.
That's right. The only other place that we had any objections was the section 135, subsection 3. We think the execution of a search warrant, for practical reasons, should be permitted at any time of the day or night within the five-day period that date of issuance.
No, he wants the time out, 7 a.m. to 10 p.m. out.
In practice, the federal government now demands something similar to this, and what happens in practice is every time they get a search warrant, of course, they get the endorsement of the judge on it, and it's just a waste of time, because that's what anyone would have to do in practice, serving these warrants. You can't get a warrant, expect to serve it always in the daytime. And that's all I have.
I have one question that isn't related to this at all, but it's easier than picking up the telephone. Justice of the Peace in Lane County have said that your officers won't serve bench warrants. Is that a top-level decision, or is that local?
No, I think we'll serve them.
Okay.
It's been a local problem.
Okay, fine. Thank you. David Hunter.
I'm David Hunter, captain for the Salem City Police, and speaking both for and against Article 5, I support this Article 5 from the standpoint of a police officer. However, I feel that we may be creating problems as far as the courts are concerned regarding interpretation of many items in here. It definitely does give police officers specific guidelines to go by, which we feel is necessary in our changing times and changing Supreme Court decisions. I have one item here, and then I'll quit, but I wanted to go directly on record as supporting Section 143 regarding custodial search, the vehicle inventory search. Municipal police officers are frequently required to take people into custody under arrest, and if we do not impound the car, it would be left unguarded out on the city street, which would create a definite problem for the owner of the vehicle should he return and find the vehicle broken into and articles removed. We feel we have a certain liability to protect everyone's property, including the subject arrested. And as such, if we do not secure the vehicle and inventory the contents of the car, we cannot guarantee or assure that individual that his property could be retained. Therefore, we do strongly support this particular article.
143 in its entirety.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Hunter. Anyone else who had comments? Don, I think you'd find us brighter another day if you want to hold your comments.
Yeah,
unless you want to go ahead.
No, I think what you've heard already gives you an indication of the situation that the commission is faced with.
Yeah, well, I'm sure we want to hear your comments, but I don't think you, the Senator, or Hoy, there are too bright right now.
Thank you.
Hearing's adjourned.